Grand Rapids' on-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash pool area with water slides and a hot tub. More details at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Not guilty and also guilty, Sean Diddy Combs is acquitted of racketeering and sex trafficking, but found guilty of prostitution-related charges. A reporter tells us about the chaotic scene outside the courthouse when that verdict came down.
And some amateur musicians have really spread their wings. We'll hear from a musician who found a way to make music with moths. She tells us she came away with a huge appreciation for what the small, unsung pollinators have to contribute.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
We'll have more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXC. We'll also hear the set list with Malachi Coons. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60 and mostly sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 80s. For Friday, scattered showers and thunderstorms throughout the day. Otherwise, sunny, highs 88 to 92 and breezy south winds. Grand Rapids Riverfest is coming up Saturday, September 6th. We are excited to welcome Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. We're going to hear a song right now from Margot Price. This one's called Letting Me Down.
This is the setlist on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. The day after the 4th of July is a busy one, with all spotlighted shows taking place this Saturday in Walker, Bemidji, Coleraine, and Duluth. Starting things off, the Crop Dusters are playing at the Green Scene Market and Eatery at 11 a.m. in Walker. They are a five-piece country rock band from the Fargo-Moorhead area who are releasing their debut album later this year. They have one single out so far called Northern Lights. In Bemidji, there is a multi-band punk show at the Rail River Folk School with music beginning at 4:30. Seven bands from Bemidji, Duluth, Minneapolis, and Fargo are playing throughout the day. ranging from shoegaze and metal to punk and alt rock, and including Hollis Sparhawk's Willem Dafoe Fan Club. It's this Saturday in Bemidji at Rail River Folk School. In Coleraine, Old Time Quartet, Sugar on the Roof are playing at Smoke on the Water at 5 p.m. It's the first of a six-show run throughout the Upper Midwest. The Iron Range group, led by Megan Reynolds, will bring an authentic mix of country, swing, jazz, and blues from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And the final featured show on the set list this week is the annual Trampled by Turtles Summer Bayfront Concert in Duluth. Since last year's edition, the bluegrass group released the Always Here, Always Now collaboration with Dead Man Winner, and they recently backed up their friend and 2025 Riverfest opener Alan Sparhawk on his latest solo release. Joining the Turtles in Duluth are 2024 Riverfest performer S.G. Goodman and the 2025 Palomino Grant winner Sophie Hiroko. Music begins at 6 p.m. All four shows on the set list today, again, are taking place Saturday. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Case closed. Sean Diddy Combs gets a split verdict from a New York jury. We'll hear from a reporter who was there to capture the chaotic reaction outside the courthouse.
Where there's smoke and where there isn't, the head of a French hotel and restaurant association reacts to the country's new limits on outdoor smoking, saying that if they come for his patios, it would be a drag.
Trial by fire is on the fourth anniversary of the deadly fire in Lytton, BC. One first responder tells us he and his team have learned to be prepared to fight off new fires all the time, as they had to do just this week.
A scandal of biblical proportions, remembering the late Jimmy Swaggart's appearance on this program in 1987 when he accused fellow televangelist Jim Baker of immoral character just months before his own catastrophic fall from grace.
Word of Moth, a British musician, explains how she created a haunting piece of music with an orchestra made up of more than 80 species of moths.
And they really got the windfall knocked out of them. Thousands of Norwegians were told they had won millions in the lottery, only for the lottery CEO to tell them they hadn't, and to apologize for accidentally putting the decimal point in the wrong place. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that thinks that took a lot of nerve. In one of his biggest hits, Sean Diddy Combs declared himself a bad boy for life, a self-description that now seems wildly inadequate. But it seems like he won't go to prison for life, although he may still face substantial time behind bars. Today, a New York jury found the hip-hop mogul guilty of transporting two former girlfriends and male escorts over state lines and borders for sex parties he called freak-offs. He was acquitted of the more serious charges of racketeering and sex trafficking. Amber Ferguson covered the trial as a video producer for The Washington Post. We reached her in Manhattan earlier today.
Amber, when this verdict came down and then that news trickled down to you and everyone else waiting outside, you know, it was already a spectacle out there. What happened when the news came?
When the verdict came down shortly after 10, it was kind of mayhem. His family was quickly gathering. He looked pretty somber, Diddy. And outside, it was just like, everyone was just like waiting by their phones, trying to get live updates from different news outlets. And then immediately when count one, which was the racketeering charge, came down as not guilty, it was kind of mayhem. And then as the other charges and counts started being read, it was just really mixed emotions down there. His supporters really brought up race a lot, saying they just wanted to take a black man down. They just wanted to take a black man down, not today. And then other people were like, he should have been found guilty on all charges. But honestly, the craziest thing happened. This guy took off his shirt, and then another guy handed him like a bottle of baby oil. And we know baby oil was a pretty big topic in this case. And he started slathering himself with baby oil, which created its own spectacle.
There's always
going to be some level of spectacle when celebrities are involved, but this is obviously a very, very serious case. In terms of those who are hoping for a different outcome outside that courtroom, how are they dealing with this news? And I'm thinking of victims' rights groups, advocacy groups, who, you know, you're talking about consent in this case, and so many other layers of questions of abuse. What are they saying in response?
Yeah, so last week, a sexual assault survivors group did a demonstration outside the courthouse, and I asked them, what does justice in this case mean for you? And they said, of course, they wanted a guilty verdict, but they were honestly just so proud of Cassie and Jane taking the stand and detailing everything that happened to them. And they said that sexual abuse survivors are really misunderstood. And earlier today, Aubrey O'Day, who was a member of Dan DeCane, which Diddy formed, she took to a video on Instagram and she says, this makes me physically ill. And she previously said, I would like to see all of the crimes that I know are true for him to serve time for all of those.
Were people there surprised? I mean, specifically, were you surprised as someone who's been covering this trial as the part of a team of journalists for your newspaper, The Washington Post, covering this? Were you surprised by the decision from the jury, the split decision?
You know, it's been a roller coaster of emotions going back and forth for the past week. When I first came here to New York, we did kind of think it was going to be guilty on most of the most serious charges. But as the prosecution was presenting its case, it became really clear late last week, especially during the defense's closing arguments, that the mood was shifting. Diddy seemed to be lighter in court, more jubilant, actually, sometimes even smiling and laughing with his attorneys. Things were different. I was talking to a lot of journalists. They were like, the prosecution didn't seem like they did a strong enough job bringing enough evidence forward. This was a really murky case. He was in a longstanding relationship with both Jane and Cassie Ventura. And it was really difficult to differentiate what was consensual, what was not consensual. Money was involved. His city's defense attorney last week was saying this is a case of love and money. And I think it was very difficult for the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury that this was racketeering.
Cassie Ventura's lawyer, Douglas Wider, commented outside the courtroom after the verdict came down. We'll listen to a bit of that now.
We're pleased that he's been held responsible for something, which is something that hasn't happened in his lifetime. And, you know, we're hopeful that ultimately he receives a substantial sentence.
And that's, again, was Douglas Wider, the lawyer representing Cassie Ventura in this case. As we're speaking, we should let our listeners know there's still some time yet before the judge will decide on whether or not Sean Combs is going to get bail. That lawyer we just heard from submitted a letter to the court asking for the judge to deny Sean Combs' request for bail in this case. How much could he face? How much time is he facing behind bars in terms of sentencing for the two charges he was found guilty of?
For the two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, the maximum for each sentence carries 10 years.
And on the lower end of that, I mean, there was so much relief, I think, from his supporters. And what's the low end of a conviction for these charges?
The low end is literally probation. It's 0 years in prison. I mean, obviously it could be community service or fine or other things like that, but he could just do time served and just walk. We obviously won't find out until he's sentenced.
You, as I mentioned, are part of a team of Washington Post reporters. I believe there's seven of you, and if I'm not mistaken, all women. And I wonder what it's like, what it's been like for all of you to cover this case, given that women are at the center of this.
A lot of us are younger women. I mean, I grew up watching Making the Band. My first concert was Dana DeCane. Mm-hmm. So I knew about Diddy's music influence my whole life, honestly. So for me, I knew I wanted to be involved in this because I knew I brought context and perspective. You know, our target audience at the Washington Post is probably not the target audience that cares that much about Diddy. But I think our coverage has been so comprehensive and good, and we've brought in so many new readers and viewers because we're breaking it down for everyone.
Amber, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Amber Ferguson is a video producer with The Washington Post. We reached her in New York City. After we spoke to Ms. Ferguson, the court ruled against Sean Combs' request for bail. Usually, the one heartening aspect of the anniversary of a tragic or traumatic event is that it's in the past. The loss isn't necessarily diminished over time, but the event itself has become more distant. But that is not the case in Lytton, BC. For everyone who lives there and on a number of nearby First Nations reserves, the wildfires that ravaged their communities 4 years ago this week are still an ever-present threat. On Monday, a fire broke out just across the Fraser River. Unlike the one in 2021, this fire did not jump to the east side where most of Lytton's residents live, and today it's officially classified as held. But there's no telling what might have happened without the early interventions of local volunteers. Farmer and business owner John Mundell is among those who saw smoke and rushed to the scene. Tricia Thorpe is an area director for the region. She lost her own home in the 2021 fires. We reached them both just outside Lytton.
John, let me start with you. If we go back to Monday, how and when did you first realize there was a new fire?
Yeah, so it's my parents' 40th wedding anniversary.
Oh,
and so it was very exciting. So the whole family is getting together for supper. We're all just having a good time and all hanging out and enjoying some good food and just sitting down to enjoy it. And we're looking out our windows and we could see there was smoke. And so we all just ran out and jumped in our pickup trucks and went to see, you know, what we could do to help.
So you jumped into action very, very quickly. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what you did and how long you had to do it?
Yeah, so we had two pickup trucks ready to go with totes and pumps. And so they headed out immediately. So they were there in about 6 minutes. My truck, I didn't have it quite set up. So I was there about 15 minutes after the fire started. And there's fire everywhere. So we weren't sure exactly where to start. But we just kind of thought we'd kind of block it off a little bit from moving upwards into a more forested section and just try to pin it off.
And how long were you there?
We were there until 3 a.m. working at things. BC Wildfire showed up really quickly, and there were a hardworking bunch of guys there. They were, when we left at 3 a.m, we'd worked with them from a little after 7:30 when we arrived. And when we showed up the next morning at 8:39, the same guys were still out there.
And Tricia, what does it say to you that people in Lytton are able to respond to a fire like this so efficiently?
I think it's amazing, and I think it's well needed. BC Wildfire is like this giant mega army type thing, for lack of a better way of describing it. And these little groups like John is talking about are crucial to communities like ours. What John didn't say is that for the BC Wildfire Service to get there, they had to cross a ferry, and it's a two-car ferry. So that takes time, and having a group like John's that's already prepared and can be there quickly helps knock it back and keep it somewhat under control until BC Wildfire can get there. And at that point, the group can either stand down or they can work in tandem with BC Wildfire, which they did.
And I wonder for you, Tricia, obviously there are the practical implications of another fire emerging. It also coincided with the fourth anniversary of the 2021 fire. But I wonder for you, beyond those practical implications, the emotional implications of a fire of any size.
Well, it's hard on a community, and it's hard when it hits on the anniversary. But I'm going to be really blunt because I work best with blunt. This isn't the first wildfire on the west side. It happens almost on a yearly basis, and it's hard. And this one is raising awareness because it happened on the anniversary. And not to downplay that, because frankly, that 2021 wildfire altered people's lives forever, including my husband and myself. We lost everything in that wildfire. But it continues to happen. And I think that as a country and as a province, we need to look at why it continues to happen and look at ways to mitigate and have groups like John's group, because they're the boots on the ground.
What else would you like to see, Tricia, change and be done to address all of those concerns you just talked about and the reality that this is now a regular occurrence for your community?
I'd like to see more funding put into these groups and acceptance. I think that we need to have proper training. We need to have the right equipment, better fire smarting, and more resources put into things like that. And I think on a personal level, I think we need to have things like the Minister of Forests, etc., actually talking to the people that are boots on the ground. We had an election here last year in BC, and in the spring, the Minister of Forest, he went around to the communities having something he called Listen and Learn. Well, he met with the municipalities, but he neglected to meet with the unincorporated, as far as I know, and we're the ones living it. And I think that if he wants to really listen and learn, that they need to talk to the people that are living it, not just the municipalities.
I would say in our community, we're pretty fortunate that we have a good relationship with the wildfire, units, and, we work together really well. What we're hearing from other people in other areas is they have had difficulty working, with roadblocks and police blockades. I know just north of us with the fire that recently started, I guess yesterday, we had several friends up there that had, commercial trucks with water cannons and water equipment and stuff that were going out to fight the fire, and they were blocked by the police blockade that was there, and they weren't allowed to attend to the fire. So I think if there is areas for improvement, even just, taking financial, all that out of it, even just supporting, recognizing and appreciating and, opening doors for people that want to help, I think more people would respond if they felt like they weren't going to be turned around or sent back.
You both clearly love Lytton. You're fighting for it in more ways than one. But I'll ask both of you, has there been a point, given how common this threat of fire is now, that you've considered moving somewhere else? Tricia, I'll ask you first.
It did occur to us right after 21, when we thought all of our animals had perished in the fire. Then we found out that some hadn't, and our goal was to look after them. And to be honest, it was community that brought me back. My husband is fourth generation, but I've only been here about 17 years. But there were people, John's family included, that reached out to us and said, hey, we want you back. We can find you a place to stay. We can help you. And it was that sense of community that really pulled me back.
And John?
Our family's planted roots here. My dad was born here. Our family farm goes way back here. And I think that, there's definitely a sense of, this place is home. We're going to learn to live with it. We're going to learn to work with it, whatever comes. We just have to adapt. And that's been the story of civilization, going way back, as we have to adapt. And I think it's just part of what we do.
Well, John, Tricia, I thank you both for your time. Please take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Mundall is a farmer and business owner, and Tricia Thorpe is the director of the Blue Sky Country area with the Thompson-Nicola Regional District. We reached them both just outside Lytton, BC. We reached out to BC's Ministry of Forests for a response to this story. The ministry was not able to provide a comment before we went to air today. song was created by tiny artists that have been seeking out the spotlight for millions of years. Well, they're seeking out any light at all, really. One night in Salisbury, England, more than 80 species of moths fluttered onto a sensor. And from those data, this piece, called Moth Times Human, was born. This moth music will have its London premiere this weekend, and it was the brainchild of musician Ellie Wilson. We reached her in Harlow, England.
Ellie, it is so beautiful. Haunting, I think, as well. Those are a couple of the words that come to mind as I hear that. What does it evoke for you at this point?
I think that's right. I mean, what I wanted was for the audience to feel immersed in a kind of nighttime world. Mm. And so, yeah, those words of haunting and dark and sort of slightly foreboding, but not necessarily in a bad way, yeah, but just sort of kind of unsure way, unsettling maybe.
Yeah, it wasn't frightening per se, but no, definitely those things that you said there is a darkness there. How much of what we heard there should be credited to the moths themselves?
Well, basically, everything that you heard there should be credited to the moths. I mean, not the sounds, obviously, because yeah, I've given them the sounds, yeah, so that we can hear their activity. But that piece, that section is right from the start of the piece, and it's using data that has been given to me by biodiversity scientists of moth activity on location in the UK. And that's just one evening of data on a location that had lots of really, really good moth activity. There was 80 different species of moths. And each moth has been assigned a different sound. So in that music that you heard, you can hear glockenspiels and soft synths and pianos and celestes and various other instruments. Each one of those sounds has been given to a different species of moth. So what you're hearing is every time that sound comes in, that was when that moth appeared during that evening. And so they have created the ebb and flow of the movement of that evening. And then I've helped it by giving them some sounds so that we can all hear it audibly. Yeah.
And as you were stitching all of this together, what did they teach you?
What did they teach me? I don't know. I just have an absolute fascination with them. I had a sort of curiosity about them in the past, but I think working on this project, I now absolutely just think they're amazing insects. And I think they are forgotten because they come out at nighttime when we're asleep. And we don't see so many of them. And in the UK, there's over 2,500 species of moths. I mean, I probably have seen maybe 10 in my life, yeah, you know, that I've known of anyway. So I think, yeah, I've just had this newfound love of them and the fact that they're just as important as bees and butterflies for pollinating. And, you know, they are, as many insects, in significant decline because of habitat loss and climate change. And, you know, it's something that we need to be talking about.
And your piece is very much also about biodiversity, and you illustrated that within the music as well.
Yeah, that was really important. What I wanted to do was not only have the piece of music partly created by the moths themselves, but I wanted it to illustrate declining biodiversity in sort of audio form. So what I've done is I've used two sets of data at the start of the piece, which is the bit that we just heard. It's really active. There's lots and lots of moth activity. It's from a really, really good grassland location that has loads and loads of insect activity. And then at the end of the piece, I use different data, which is from farmland in Cambridgeshire. And they use pesticides, and it's a monoculture. And it's the same night, same time, and it's so sparse. There's hardly any moth activity. It's a really, really notable decline between the two, yeah.
That sense of foreboding you talked about.
Exactly.
What we heard was just 30 seconds. This is a 12-minute piece, if I'm not mistaken. It's going to be played, premiered on Saturday in London. How is that going to unfold for the audience that's there?
So the bit at the beginning is audio that will run throughout the live performance. And so what we have also on top of that is five live musicians, of which one of those is me on the violin. And then we have another violin, a cello, a trombone, and piano and synthesizers. And what we do is we sort of interweave in and out of what the Moths have created. In some places, the Moths have kind of managed to create little fragments of melodies. And so what I've done is I've taken those little melodies and I've given them to the piano or I've given them to the cello. So it's a sort of like a kind of interspecies dialogue. I like to see it as sort of, but it's just a really, really nice way of imitating the Moths. So the fluttering and things like that. The cello has a really nice little bit where she taps on the body of the cello, kind of imitating the sound of a moth that's sort of trapped inside a light shade. So little sort of fun things like that as well, that just kind of have been inspired by moths and what I think about them.
It must be wonderful to be able to perform at any time, play, you know, to do your art, play your music, but this kind of a dialogue or duet, you know, with moths, what does that feel like?
It feels great. I'm just so pleased to be bringing it to an audience and to get people thinking about moths and thinking about their impact in our world and getting excited about them. And it was really, I have played it already. I played it up in Bradford, which is up in the north of England. And I had audience members coming to me afterwards saying, I'm going to be thinking about moths in a different way. And, I didn't realize there was that many species of moths. So I think, you know, people going away thinking, I think job done, you know. I think someone said they cried. I'm not sure I was trying to make them cry, but in a way, I'm glad it had an emotional impact.
I'm glad too. Ellie, such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks very much.
We reached Ellie Wilson in Harlow, England. It's hard to imagine winning the lottery. Actually, I mean, it's easy to imagine it. It should probably be harder to imagine, in fact. What I mean is that it's hard to know what it would really feel like. And now, several thousand Norwegians no longer have to guess. On Friday, Eurojackpot told them they had all won millions, and they were all very excited. One man says he was so overcome with excitement that he proposed to his girlfriend right then and there. Now, though, he and the other big winners have been brought to their knees for a much less romantic reason. It turns out that the state-owned gambling company Norsk Tipping made a little error when converting the winnings from euros to kroner, an error involving just a tiny decimal point, which they moved just a couple of places the wrong way. But, you know, if you're familiar with the way decimal points work, moving that dot meant that instead of dividing by 100, the winnings got incorrectly multiplied by 100. The big winners were now small winners, and the small winners were hugely disappointed. In a statement, the company CEO said she had received a lot of messages from people who had already made plans for their money and continued, quote, "To them, I can only say, sorry, exclamation mark, but I understand that it is a small consolation," unquote. She has since resigned, which probably also won't be much consolation to people who thought they'd won a jackpot, but had really won Jack. Here's Hot Chocolate with Everyone's a Winner. Chocolate with Everyone's a Winner.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, France says au revoir to smoking in outdoor areas where children might hang out, including beaches and parks. But so far, that new law does not cover cafe patios. The head of a French hospitality association tells us that makes them the last bastions of freedom in France.
And Eat, Pray, Love. A scientist tells us what it's like to be offered a gift by an orca while out on the water in the form of a fairly gross dead thing that, to the orca, would have been a nice snack.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Annie Lou and Nelson, your volunteer hosts for On the River. They'll bring you a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, more great music on Headwaters with Kari Headland. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, reminding you that speeders will pay a price, maybe the ultimate price. Please slow down. Extra speed patrols now on Minnesota roads. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 80s. Southeast winds 5 to 10. Looking ahead to Friday, the 4th of July, scattered showers and thunderstorms with sunny skies and highs 88 to 92, breezy south winds. Heartland Arts presents the Northwinds Clarinets Thursday, July 10th, 12:15 at Calvary Lutheran Church in Park Rapids. They will play a variety of genres on many different size clarinets. We continue with As It Happens.
For a long time in France, lighting a cigarette while you sipped your coffee or cocktail was simply de rigueur. Images of French icons from Brigitte Bardot to Serge Gainsbourg to Charles de Gaulle featured a Gauloise in a prominent co-starring role, to the point where cigarettes seemed as much a part of the cultural fabric as raw milk cheese or a classic Bordeaux. But now the role of smoking in French culture is getting a little hazier. A new law bans smoking in public areas popular with kids, including parks, beaches, and sporting venues. Smokers who break the rules face a 90-euro fine, which is $144 Canadian. Franck Thouet is the executive director of the Hospitality Association Hotels and Restaurants of France. We reached him in Paris.
Franck, I wonder what's happening around you in Paris. Are people following the new rules?
Yes, people are following the new rules. And I say immediately that these new rules, it's not mandatory on our terraces. I mean the terrace of our restaurant and cafe.
Right. Terraces and bars are not covered by this. Vaping is not covered by this. But it is outdoor spaces that are where children might be present, parks, beaches, other kind of, you know, sporting areas as well. I wonder what is at the heart of this for you. We know France's health and family minister, Catherine Vautrin, said, quote, tobacco must disappear from places where there are children, a park, a beach, a school. These are places to play, learn, and breathe, not for smoking, unquote. That is what is at the heart of it for her. What is at the heart of this issue for you?
Well, you know, for us, the most important thing, we really want to protect this last spaces of liberty, of freedom, where people, I mean smokers and non-smokers, are able to enjoy together a friendly and free atmosphere with a lot of pleasure.
What do you think about the other rules, though? You're not affected now. What do you think about the rule about parks?
You know, I'm really wondering about the reason of these rules. I mean, it is forbidden to smoke inside our cafe and restaurant because there is a healthy reason. It is not good to work with an atmosphere of smoke because of the cigarette. Mm-hmm. But you don't have this kind of problem outside. So we do not understand people saying that we should ban smoking on terraces because it is not good for health. No,
There have been studies that suggest that secondhand smoke, even thirdhand smoke, is an issue, particularly for children outside. The health minister says that this is about health. You don't think so?
I think that it is a question of model. She doesn't want, and maybe she's right, she doesn't want children to see adults smoking. Okay, I understand it. But you know that some parents are smoking in front of their children. I do care of the health of all the people in France. But it is not to smoke of a cigarette on a terrace for less than 5 minutes outside, of course, that is a problem of perfume. It is a problem of we do not like the smell of cigarette.
It sounds like you think this is going to change and actually affect your businesses and your terraces. Are you worried?
Maybe. Yes, this is the key problem for us. When we decided to ban smoking inside the restaurant, it was not a heavy problem because we have the terraces. Mm-hmm. But now, if we say that it is not possible to smoke anymore on the terrace, we will have again less and less customers. Mm-hmm. It is one of the last spaces in France where you can have a cohabitation between smokers and non-smokers.
This is about, it sounds like, not just French culture, but freedom.
Yes, absolutely. It is a question of freedom, of liberty, as we say in France. And that's the reason why we are saying we can't push the owner of cafe and restaurant into the unknown.
Yeah. Do you think smokers would get used to it, though, and just smoke elsewhere, not smoke on the patio? They'll still come, won't they?
We saw already that when we ban smoking on terraces, more customers are going away.
Are you a smoker yourself?
I'm a young smoker, yes.
What does that mean?
I'm an old guy, but I am a young smoker.
You just started recently?
I started 5 years ago, and
oh,
I'm
Frank,
58.
Why, Frank?
Oh, I'm always doing the different way than people. I wanted to taste it.
You like to go against the grain, the opposite of what maybe, the trend
maybe,
is.
Yes.
Do you imagine, though, a world of a France where, you know, change comes and those wonderful terraces are there, but the cigarettes are not?
I would like not to imagine it, because it means that at the same time there are people will have to smoke on the street, like it happens already in some countries. I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, it is also a question of equality between people. People who have free private outdoor space and the other one, they won't be able. No. I know it's not good for health, but you know, it's a decision of the people. I will always say that we are French. Freedom is the most important value for us.
Freedom for non-smokers too, though, right?
Freedom for all of us.
Frank, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Franck Trouet is the executive director of the Hospitality Association Hotels and Restaurants of France. He's in Paris. The majority of athletes are all about optimism, visualizing success, never giving up. The majority of goths believe optimism is wrong, existentialism is best, or at least fine, and that the wise choice is to focus on the darkness. So you don't see a lot of goth athletes, or what you might call gothletes. But semi-professional Australian basketball player Caitlin Cunningham, also known as Caitlin Dark, after the American women's WNBA phenom Caitlin Clark, is going viral for their goth look, which includes heavy black eye makeup, neck tattoos, and permanent fangs, professionally sharpened by the family dentist. It's an intimidating look, and they're 6'4", which makes them an imposing figure to face at center court or even to bump into at a coffee shop. But as Caitlin Cunningham explained to ABC Melbourne presenter Rochelle Hunt, their look is just about self-expression.
Did you always wear your makeup on court?
I was a MySpace kid, emo. Music's a big part of my life, and so the makeup has always been, I guess, an expression, and I've always done it. So
when you hear people push back about fashion, it's just nothing but commercialization.
No.
It's just about money making. And yes, there is a part of that, right? But for many of us, it's identity, 100%. It's security.
Yeah, there's so much more that goes into fashion. It's such a way to express yourself with who you are, your creativity, what you're into, because if you wear a certain thing, that's just almost a badge of honor to relate to someone else who might be into that same thing. It's a showcase of, yeah, your personality. And I think it's more than just fashion. I think style, it comes into an extension of your personality. Mm. So it's how you present, you show up. And obviously I could talk all day about fashion, but there's so many levels and splinters that come off it. But the ultimate umbrella, it's like music. It's a world. It's like an extra sense we have. It's a language. It's a representation. There's so much more that comes into it.
Does everyone just sort of know, okay, yep, you know, look, we're playing that team today where I'm going to be against Caitlin Cunningham. Be prepared for the makeup, for the look.
I think a lot of people know who I am and know my personality, and I might look quite intimidating, but I am probably one of the most softest, most gentle people, and everyone knows that. So I don't think I intimidate even with the way I look. I think people just... It's one of those things that's don't judge a book by its cover. I am such a contradiction of what I am perceived as to who I am.
Caitlin Cunningham plays semi-professional basketball for the Rockland Cyclones in Queensland. Jimmy Swaggart made his fortune by preaching about the temptations of the flesh, and ultimately those temptations would be his downfall. At his peak, the televangelist was worth tens of millions of dollars, which he brought in by appealing to his millions of TV devotees. But in the late 1980s, he was caught on camera entering a motel with a sex worker, and that would not be the only time. He was eventually defrocked by the Assemblies of God. Jimmy Swaggart died yesterday. He was 90. In 1987, just months before his very public fall from grace, Mr. Swaggart denounced a fellow televangelist, Jim Baker, for revelations that the leader of the PTL television ministry had had a sexual encounter with a church secretary. Mr. Baker would later resign from PTL for covering up hush money he paid to that secretary, Jessica Hahn, who said he'd raped her. He denied that, but was found guilty of multiple counts of felony fraud. Before all that, Jim Baker's lawyer came on this program and accused Jimmy Swaggart of trying to take over the multi-million dollar business. And the next night on As It Happens, Mr. Swaggart responded.
So I really feel that there was a smokescreen to try to get the people's mind and attention off of what had been printed by the Charlotte Observer, which was, of course, very damning evidence of immoral activities. And this was a good way to stir up a hullabaloo to make people forget that, and I think that was their tactic.
Mr. Grutman told us yesterday that if Jimmy Swaggart starts messing around in the laundry hamper, that, well, he's got a few things in his, what he called his doomsday machine, revelations which would come out if you pursued this matter further.
Well, I told him to go right ahead and reveal anything that he had, because really he has nothing. And he told me that to start with at the very beginning, and along with the other lies that they told us or they accused us of. And so he's free to say anything he'd like to say, to tell the news media, and anything that he feels that he has.
Now, this whole business has the whole continent, I guess, watching prominent evangelists, people who say they're doing the Lord's work, squabbling, very sordid revelations coming out. I mean, do you regret your part in this, that perhaps the profession of evangelist is being harmed by this?
Well, I'll tell you how I got involved in it. I didn't want to say anything, but when I heard them over television accusing me of stealing $176 million worth of buildings and grounds and so forth, the PTL ministry, that's a pretty serious accusation. So I knew when I stepped out I was going to tell the truth exactly like it was, and I wasn't going to pull any punches. And that's exactly what I've done. Secondly, to your question, I feel like this is going to be good for television ministries, for the work of God as a whole. It's like the work of God has had a disease in it, and it has needed major surgery. And it is wrong for preachers to commit adultery and pop pills and take cocaine and do all of these things and then still purport to be something else. That's wrong.
You think it's time for the TV evangelists to get away from the big houses and the TV networks, as opposed to just having your program?
There's nothing wrong with bigness or smallness. That's not the problem. The problem is not money. The problem is not bigness. The problem is not network. The problem is not houses. The problem is lack of character. And that's what we're really discussing here.
From 1987, that was the late Jimmy Swaggart speaking with As It Happens guest host Vince Carlin. A few months later, the televangelist was caught on camera entering a motel with a sex worker. Mr. Swaggart died yesterday at the age of 90. It's not every day you find yourself close to a killer whale, and it's even rarer for that apex predator to offer you some of what it's eating. But somehow that has happened multiple times to Jared Towers. He has detailed those experiences in a new study published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Comparative Psychology. Mr. Towers is the executive director of Bay Cetology, a research institute in Alert Bay, British Columbia, and that's where we reached him.
Jared, it's pretty great to get a gift, but what is it like to get a gift from an orca?
Well, it's very unusual, that's for sure.
And just, you've received them a few times now. Uh-huh. That first encounter, take us to that.
Well, okay, the first encounter was a bit unusual, actually, even as far as these cases are concerned, because what happened was it was a fairly windy day, and some killer whales were killing ancient murrelets, which is a small seabird that they probably don't eat, but they were having a lot of fun torturing them. I went over to investigate one at the surface in my boat, picked it up, and checked it out, threw it back. And the killer whales, two of them, siblings, came over. They were about 50 meters away. They came over to that bird, and one of them started mouthing it at the surface. And I have a GoPro camera on a pole, and so I just put that next to the boat, directly underneath where I was standing on the vessel. And its older sibling came along, and about 12 inches from the camera, opened up its mouth and let out another dead ancient murrelet.
Oh.
And it just floated there, suspended in the water for about 5 seconds, directly in front of the camera, before it picked it up again and swam away. And I didn't know what had happened until I went home and looked at the footage.
And what did you think when you saw it and played it back?
I was amazed. You know, it really indicated that the whale was interacting with the camera and myself as the, you know, the holder of the camera, perhaps testing it out, seeing what it was capable of, and you know, asking its own questions of what we were doing and what we're capable of, perhaps.
Trying to suss things out. That's your first instinct of what was happening there.
Yeah, that was my first instinct. And then it happened again a few years later, but it was a little bit different.
So what happened that time?
Well, that time, my colleagues and I were in the research vessel and we spotted a killer whale. We stopped and it was all alone at the time. And it happened to have a dead harbor seal with it, a young one that it had just killed. And it swam directly up to the vessel. It was a perfectly calm day, clear water. And it let go of the harbor seal right underneath where we were standing. Mm. And then it swam a slow circle around the boat. And about 20 seconds later, picked up the harbor seal and swam away and began feeding on it.
So it's interesting, different kinds of prey, different sizes, certainly 3 mm-hmm. years in between these offerings. So you could have assumed that this was just a strange coincidence. Why did you decide to study it?
Well, because I think killer whales are, you know, capable of so many things that we really don't get much insight into because they live underwater and because our interactions with them are so short and infrequent. And so also, many of these interactions are people pursuing whales. But in this case, the whales went out of their way. The world's largest top apex predator going out of their way to interact with us without harming us in any way. And in my case, I was on the boat on two occasions when this happened. But in several of these other cases, this is happening underwater when people are swimming.
And have you or your colleagues ever accepted one of these offerings?
Yeah, one of my co-authors has. And there's been a few cases where people have accepted the offerings, either to retain a bit of flesh to sample, what it was that they were eating to verify the species, or just because they're engaging in the game, or perhaps turning it into a game. In one case, a man in BC was offered a dead bird, and he picked it up and threw it back, and the whale retrieved it and brought it back, and then he threw it back into the ocean. And this kind of went on and on. For a little while, and it turned into a bit of a game, so to speak.
So what ultimately did your research find? What does it suggest?
Well, it suggests a few things, or at least it highlights a few things that we already know about killer whales. Is first, they're highly evolved animals. They have the brain capacity to ask questions about what's happening in their environment. And before we get to that, though, I mean, the first point I'd like to make is that killer whales are predators of relatively large prey in many occasions. And so sometimes they just have more prey than they know what to do with. And so the cost of sharing is very low in these cases. They're good at acquiring resources, put it that way. Secondly, prey sharing is probably foundational to the evolution of killer whales, just like it is for us. You know, we've evolved different kinds of reciprocity, and our brains have grown very large because we share food with each other. The same is true for killer whales. And so prey sharing with other species may be just a way to practice learned cultural behavior. But because killer whales are quite curious, they occasionally, as it seems, are exploring the capacity of humans to engage in reciprocity, which is very unusual because it's normally only our species that goes around experimenting with others, you know, domesticating them, training them, offering them food, even if we have empathy for them. And so we can't rule out that any of these things may be the reasons why killer whales are offering us food. Maybe we look like we need it.
They're trying to train you.
Perhaps.
It's obviously you're looking through it through a very serious scientific lens, but it must feel, you know, just delightful when it's happening, that sort of play that you mentioned.
Yeah, it's you kind of have to savor the moment because it is very rare, and it's touching in a way that is very unique.
I'm glad we could speak, Jared. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jared Towers is the executive director of Bay Cetology, a research institute in Alert Bay, BC. That's where we reached him.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.